looking at the Agadata in the 11th parak of Sanhedrin, that's parak chelek, and we just looked at one line the other time. In other words, the first line begins, Kol Yisrael yesh lehem chelek le'olam haba. That means every single Jew, as soon as you're born, you have a share in the world to come. As tomorrow we'll discuss, maybe even before you're born, but you know, you're guaranteed a chelek, and as you know, if you learn Pirkei Avos, when people learn Pirkei Avos between Pesach and Shavuos, so they preface the chapter with that line, Kol Yisrael Yesh Lam Chelek Lo Ba. That's not part of Pirkei Avos, that's taken from this Mishnah, but they only give you half of it, because after the Mishnah says every Jew has a share in the world to come, it then says, oh, but the following people don't, meaning it's not a it's a contradiction. Then how can you say everybody has a share in the world to come? And the answer basically is, the Mishnah's diuk is very important. It doesn't say, Kol Yisrael yesh lam chelek ba olam haba. If it would say ba olam haba, that means everybody has a share in the world to come. So you then can't say, and these people don't. You just said everybody has a share in it. But li olam haba is everyone has a right to go towards olam haba, meaning to say you can make choices to get you that share, but if you make certain negative choices, you could lose that share. It's like as if to say everybody is born with $1 million, but you can spend it, you can waste it, you can throw it away. And the Mishnah then, therefore, most of the Mishnah is devoted not to explaining who has a share, but it's devoted to explaining who doesn't, who does not have a share. And what's important is that the Mishnah does not enumerate sins so much as it enumerates a failure to have proper beliefs. So it doesn't say here if a person desecrates Shabbos or whatever it is. Even if a person violates Shabbos and does the worst averos, they will get punished for it, to be sure, but they don't lose Olam Haba. They will get Olam Haba. But for certain things, we'll see in a moment, there is not a share. One forfeits a share in Olam Haba. V'shteitzach, one has to understand that this is only true if they do not do tshuva. In other words, there's no avera whatsoever which will not help if one does tshuva. So the Mishnah starts off, Kol Yisrael yesh lehem chelek le'olam haba. Every Jew is born with an entitlement to get Olam Haba, the future world. Remember, this is the world of the soul. This is not Mashiach or resurrection. This is the world of the soul. Shenemar, and it quotes a verse from the Navi Yeshayahu, V'yameich kulam tzadikim. Your nation, meaning Hashem's nation, your nation is filled with righteous people. Kulam, they're all considered righteous. Li olam yirshu oretz, they shall inherit the land forever. Netzer mata'ai, they are the creation of my planting. Mata'ai is my planting. Ma'ase yodai, they are the creatures of my hands. Lehis pa'er, to be glorified by me. Now, just as a matter of naked interpretation, this pasuk is being cited to prove that everybody has a share in the world, every Jew has a share in the world to come. How does this pasuk prove everyone has a share in the world to come? The pasuk doesn't say it's talking about Olam Haba. It says, your nation are all righteous, they shall forever inherit the land. What in that pasuk is referring to Olam Haba? So the Rambam says the following. The Rambam says in Hilchos Tshuva that Olam Haba has many, many metaphors. Since Olam Haba is a purely spiritual world, it is not a world of eating or drinking. It is not a world of bodily pleasure, unlike the Islamic belief that everybody gets all of these pleasures in Olam Haba. We also believe Olam Haba is a world of pleasure, but it's a world only of spiritual pleasure. The neshama is totally not connected to a body at all. So the Rambam says, because of this, however, because we can't understand a purely spiritual pleasure that is not connected to some sensation of the body, the Nevi'im, as well as Chazal, use metaphors and mishalim of physicality to give us a little taste and vision of what Olam Haba is like. So they will talk about eating and drinking, they will talk about drinking wine, they will talk about sitting at golden tables filled with jewels. But all of that is not going to happen. There's not going to be wine, and there's not going to be food, and there's not going to be tables, and there's not going to be thrones. All of these are expressions for certain spiritual delights. Therefore, the Rambam says that Olam Haba is sometimes referred to as the land. Not because it is a land, but because it's a way of giving us a visualization of it. And since this pasuk says, they shall inherit the land forever, it can't mean the physical earth, because nobody is going to be on the physical earth forever. So the only thing that's forever is actually Olam Haba. And therefore, indirectly, this pasuk is referring to Olam Haba. And by saying, all of your nation is righteous, that doesn't mean we end up righteous, we might end up not righteous, but it means we're born into the world in a state of purity and righteousness, and that therefore gives us the entitlement to inherit Olam Haba. But like anybody else who has a big inheritance, you can squander it, we can squander it as well. Right? So that's what this pasuk says. So this part is optimistic, and this part is what we read when we learn Pirkei Avos. But then it goes on and says, V'elu she'ein lahem chelek li'olam haba. But the following people lose it. They don't get a share in the world to come. Now what happens? Again, it doesn't mean... That's interesting. It doesn't really spell it out here. It doesn't mean eternal damnation, meaning to say there's getting Olam Haba and there's not getting Olam Haba. But not getting Olam Haba does not mean somebody burns in Gehenna forever and ever. It does mean annihilation, which again, from some perspective, people think is not so bad, but for the neshama, it really is an awful thing. The neshama simply loses its chance to connect to God. It's simply dead. It's gone. When the body goes, the neshama goes. Now, the Kabbalists introduced the idea, which is not in Chazal specifically, of reincarnation and Gilgal, which suggests that if a person did not merit acquiring Olam Haba in this world, they are given a second, third, fourth, many, many chances to come back. Gilgal is not mentioned in the Gemara. So we could not call it a definite Jewish belief. The Rambam does not mention it either. But the great Mekubalim did endorse it, and they talked about many different types of Gilgal. Sometimes a man comes back as a woman comes back as a man, sometimes a person comes back as an animal. A dog, you know, people used to say, and if you go to Tzfat, Tzfat is a rural area, So animals hang around a lot. In the middle of JLE Kabbalah Shabbos, there might be a ram that walks in or something. We've seen this. Or a dog will come. I remember that dog just came in for a shear, and it's like sat down in the back, listened very attentively, and when the shear was over, it just got up and walked away. Now, Tzfat is a mystical city, and you never know. But people say these are Gilgulim, they hang around, different types of things. So Gilgul is really the great redeemer, in which even if a person did not earn it in this life, he's given another chance. But obviously Gilgul is not pleasant. It's interesting, the neshama does not like to come back. You think, oh, it's wonderful, I have another chance. The neshama would rather not come back at all. So it's best to try to... Well, this is probably not our first life anyway, that's another thing, but whatever life we're in, it's best to try to minimize the need to come back again. What do they say? They tell a story about the Vilna Gaon. Chabad used to tell, I don't think they tell a story anymore, but an old Chabad story, that the Vilna Gaon was a great opponent to Hasidus, and he actually excommunicated the Hasidic movement, and among those that he excommunicated was the Alter Rebbe, the first Chabad Rebbe, who was sent to meet with the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon refused to meet with him. So when the Vilna Gaon was Nifter, there were some Hasidim that actually rejoiced. The Bala Tanya was furious, he says, that number one, this is a tremendous guy in Tzaddik, the Vilna Gaon, and number two, now he's going to fight us from Shemayim. It's going to be much worse. It's not easier that the Vilna Gaon goes to Shemayim. But they used to tell this story that the Vilna Gaon was such a tzaddik and so perfect and so great that the only aveira that he had was he never heard a Hasidic Torah. So he was given a choice in Shemayim that he either has to go back to earth to hear a Hasidic Torah, or he has to spend like 1 second in Gehenna. Whatever. So the Vilna Gaon chose Gehenna. You've got to go to Gehenna to hear a Hasidic Torah. But the story they tell is, as he was being escorted to Gehenna, all of the billions, trillions, quadrillions of Dafim of Gemara and Torah that he learned, they formed the wall that literally they couldn't move forward. So the Hasidim say, no, he got out of both, didn't go to Gehenna, didn't hear a Hasidic he managed to escape the whole thing. Okay. So it says here that the following people do not have a share in the world to come. And it lists a total of initially three things. Rabbi Akiva adds a fourth thing, and then there's a fifth thing and a sixth thing. So this Mishnah has a total of six things. And if you were to make a list of like the worst six things a person can do, some of these would not necessarily be on your list. But let's see what the list is. Item number one, Haomer, Ein Techias HaMesim Min HaTorah. A person who says that resurrection of the dead cannot be found in the Torah, meaning there is no Torah source for resurrection of the dead. Now, resurrection of the dead is not the same as Olam Haba. Resurrection of the dead is, at the end of the Messianic era, the neshamos will come back into the physical bodies. And what really happens is, Olam Haba and Olam Hazeh become reunited. Now, there are two things here. A person could fall into this category, the Gemara explains, in one of two ways. One way is he doesn't believe in physical resurrection. And even if he believes in Olam Haba, the world of the soul, he doesn't believe that the soul will go back into the body. That's a case of he doesn't believe in Tchiyas HaMesim. But the Gemara says, if you read the Mishnah carefully, it's going beyond that. Because even if a person believes in resurrection, but he believes that it's not in the Torah, in other words, it's only like a tradition and it's not in the Torah, that also is heretical. In other words, it's interesting. A person is a heretic in this connection if he doesn't believe in physical resurrection. And number two, even if he believes in physical resurrection, but he feels it cannot be found in the Torah, and we'll discuss where is it found in the Torah, that also excludes him. That's pretty amazing. You would think that's pretty mild. I believe in resurrection, but I don't think the drushas you give me for resurrection are so convincing. I believe it as an oral Messiah. I believe it. Still, he doesn't ever share an Olam Haba. Now,
what is belief? Just thinking it in your head that it will happen?
That it will happen, that you believe it's true. That you believe it's true. Now, the problem is this. The Gemara will say, I'm getting ahead a little bit, that the reason why he is denied Olam Haba is in the nature of what is called Mida Keneged Mida. Mida Keneged Mida is a very, very important principle of divine justice. That basically means measure for measure. The way I behave is the way Hashem gives back to me, right? In a good way and in a bad way. So Mida Keneged Mida, since he doesn't believe in resurrection of the dead, or even if he believes, he doesn't believe it's in the Torah, he does not get the, you don't believe it? You don't get it. But there's a non sequitur here, and I think it's a strong question. The non sequitur is, if the Mishnah would say that the following people will not be resurrected from the dead, and it would say the person who denies resurrection, that would be perfect. You don't believe there's such a thing as resurrection of the dead, you don't get resurrection of the dead. But the Mishnah is not talking about resurrection of the dead. The Mishnah is talking about Olam Haba, which is the world of the soul. Now here, even if a guy doesn't believe in physical resurrection, as many indeed didn't, he could still believe in the eternity of the soul. So why would I say, because I don't believe in physical resurrection, and certainly if I believe it, but it's not in the Torah, why should that impact on Olam Haba? That should only impact on Tchiyas HaMesim, right? This kind of a non sequitur. You're basically saying, that because you don't believe in the apples, you don't get the oranges. But I believe in the oranges. Yeah. Right? Give me the oranges. I don't believe in the apples. Right. So that's actually a difficult kasha, and that almost suggests, not like the Rambam, that when the Mishnah mentions Olam Haba, it is in fact referring to resurrection of the dead. But again, the Rambam clearly says no. Olam Haba and resurrection are two different concepts. But we have to assume that resurrection is considered to be act two, or the final act of Olam Haba. In other words, essentially, when you don't believe in resurrection, you're denying a fundamental aspect, because eventually the world to come becomes part of this world. And therefore, that's considered to be a kfira in Olam Haba. But that's still a bit difficult to understand, because, paradoxically, it does not say if you deny Olam Haba, you don't get Olam Haba. It says only if you deny Tchias HaMesim. Now, maybe the Mishnah tells you the bigger Chiddush, and you can make a Kal V'chomer for the smaller Chiddush, meaning if even when I acknowledge Olam Haba, but I deny resurrection, I don't get Olam Haba. So maybe it's a Dover Peshet if I deny the whole concept of Olam Haba. It doesn't have to say it. If I deny the whole concept of Olam Haba, I don't get Olam Haba. But again, it's something to think about, because since the Rambam goes to very great detail to differentiate these concepts, you got to pay careful attention. When the Mishnah means Olam Haba, it's not Tchias HaMesim. By the way, it's interesting. The Rambam himself was accused in his lifetime of not believing in physical resurrection, although it's one of his own 13 principles of faith, because the Rambam writes quite a lot about the world of the soul, and he writes very, very little about resurrection of the dead. And in fact, overall, the Rambam seems to disparage the importance of, he doesn't deny it, of course, he affirms it, but he disparages the importance of physical resurrection, because he says the most important thing is the soul. Who really cares about the body? So he was actually accused of not believing his own principles, and he had to write a long public letter. It's called Igeres Tchias HaMesim in Arabic, the letter of resurrection of the dead, which is translated in Hebrew, to kind of defend his position. He was accused of being an Epicurus himself in that way.
This world is a closed door in order to reach Olam Haba, which is the climax.
Yeah.
Why are we being sent back down?
Yes, yes.
To be resurrected if this is closed door for us.
Yes, that's really kind of what the Rambam said, which is why he was accused. But the way you understand it is this. Tchiyat HaMesim is not sending us back. What it's doing is, it's taking the spiritual holiness of Olam Haba and it's bringing it into the physical world, so that instead of two worlds, instead of the Olam Hazeh and the Olam Haba, even the physical creation of Hashem now becomes as spiritual as Olam Haba. So really, the way Tchiyat HaMesim can be described is, it is the return to Gan Eden. Meaning to say, we're back where we started. It's funny, the whole travail of world history just brings us back where we should have been to begin with, had we not messed up with the chait of the Eitz Hadas. So really, Tchias HaMesim is the collapsing of the boundary between Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba, in which Olam Haba becomes everything at that point. Yeah.
Is this clear only for Jews?
Yes, it must be so, because the Mishnah starts off, Kol Yisrael Yesh Lahem Chelek, V'Eila Shein Lahem Chelek, is presumably qualifying Israel. About non-Jews, just a little second about, we have today, the Pope is, I don't know, you know that, I didn't know this, but I was in town and somebody told me the Pope Francis is visiting Jerusalem today. And so people raised a question about, do Goyim have a share in the world to come? So let me just remind you once again that the Rambam writes, based on the Gemara, it's not, the Rambam didn't make it up, but the Rambam writes that non-Jews who keep the seven laws of Noach, have a share in Olam Haba, and that means belief in God and not committing adultery. Relatively simple, although the Noahide laws can be complicated. But what's interesting is the Rambam says the following. And this is a bit of a chumrah, so to speak. The Rambam says the non-Jew who keeps the Noahide laws has a share in the world to come only if he's keeping those laws because he believes Hashem commanded it. In other words, if a person's a guy and I don't kill or steal just because, normal morality, but I'm not doing it because I believe Hashem commanded it, so under those circumstances, he does not have a share in the world to come. But the issue of Christianity generally, just as I guess for the Pope a little bit, is that the very first Noahide law is not to worship idols, to believe in God. So the question becomes, what is the halachic status of Christianity, which believes in Yashkan and the like? And this was an old machlokas, the Rambam and Rabbeinu Tam. In the Rambam, and this part of the Rambam was censored in the Middle Ages. We only know it from later restorations of manuscripts. The Shitas Rambam is, he differentiated between Islam and Christianity. The Rambam held that Christians are idol worshippers in violation of the Noahide law because they ascribe divinity to a human form, and the Trinity, meaning they don't believe in a single God. And therefore, the Rambam Shita was that Christianity, in his days, the only Christianity that existed was Catholicism. That was before the Protestant Reformation, or the Coptic Church, you know, various Eastern Christianities, whatever it would be, this was idolatry. Masha'ein Kain Islam, the Rambam said, although he considered Muhammad to have been insane, he writes, Muhammad Dak Meshuggah, he certainly didn't like Muhammad, but he said Islam is a monotheistic religion. No statues, no images, no idols, only one God. Ad Kidei Kach, that the Rambam said the following, an amazing thing. In a letter he wrote to a beleaguered Jewish community in Yemen, that when the Muslims were trying to forcibly convert people, they would go over to a Jew and say, you know, make the statement, whatever it is, Allah, whatever they say, or we'll kill you. The Rambam paskens that even though a Jew must give up his life before he worships idols, a Jew would be allowed to profess allegiance to Allah in order to save his life, because the Rambam held it was not Avodah Zarah. Christianity, if God forbid, like the Murano, somebody went over to a Jew and said, acknowledge Jesus or I'll slit your throat, unfortunately, you know, you'd have to give up your life. Now that's the Rambam. Rabbeinu Tam, who is, of course, Rashi's grandson, Rabbi Yaakov ben Meir, right? Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi Tam were brothers, I hope you know that. Rashi had daughters, he did not have sons, and one of his sons-in-laws was Rabbi Meir, and Rabbi Meir had more than two sons, but two sons that are most famous are Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, that is Rashbam, and Rabbi Yaakov ben Meir, who is known as Rabbeinu Tam, based on the pun that Yaakov Avinu is called Ish Tam, a perfect person. Yoshev Olam is called Rabbeinu Tam, our master, the perfect one. And Rabbeinu Tam, who lived in Catholic France, as did Rashi, took the position that Christianity, which meant Catholicism, is not Avodah Zarah for Christians, because he called it Shitah. In other words, he regarded the Trinity not as believing in multiple gods, but in ascribing that God could take different forms. And although that's an incorrect belief, but it's not a violation of the Noahide law. So according to Rabbeinu Tam, it turns out, Christians are not of the Avodah Zarah. Now, that's a very important thing to be aware of, because according to the Torah, we are not allowed to let idolaters live in the land of Israel. It's actually an issue in the Torah. So the question is, now obviously, in a modern state that's not religious, no, they're not going to start forcing this on people. But halachically, if this would be a Jewish religious state, would we be allowed to have Christian churches in the land of Israel? According to Rabbeinu Tam, the answer is yes. According to the Rambam, the answer would be no. However, I do want to point out, even like Rabbeinu Tam, if it's really idolatrous, you couldn't have it. So things like Baha'i or Hindu or the like, you know, that you wouldn't be allowed to have. Rabbeinu Tam only allows Christianity based on his understanding. So whether or not you should go greet the Pope would depend to some degree on this machlokas, the Rambam and Rabbeinu Tam. The Rambam wouldn't go visit him, wouldn't go see him. Rabbeinu Tam, perhaps might, yeah.
I think he's in the Hakdama, say, like, of Mishnah Berurah, but he writes about Avodah Zarah and Shabbos being kind of the head and the heart, spiritually. So how that impact on your chelek and the Havai?
Yeah, well it's very clear that although... Let me give you a simple example. Shabbos, not keeping Shabbos is compared to idolatry because you're making a statement that you're denying that Hashem made the world. You're 100% correct. On the other hand, you clearly see it's not exactly the same, and the proof of the matter is I could desecrate Shabbos to save my life. In other words, like this. I would have to give up my life before I worship Avodah Zarah But if my life is in danger, I'm allowed and even commanded to violate Shabbos. So you see that it's similar to Avodah Zarah, but it's not mamish the same thing. So it's very clear that if a person is mechallel Shabbos, even though there's a tremendous punishment, he absolutely does not lose his share in the world to come. Okay. So our first one is he denies Tchiyas HaMeisim, or even if he believes it, but he says it's not in the Torah. And Chazal explained that as midah keneged midah, although I'll leave you with the question to think about. Well, it's not midah keneged midah because one is Olam Haba and one is Tchiyas HaMeisim. That's the question. Okay. Second one, Ein Torah min HaShemayim. Now this is a biggie. This is indeed a biggie. He does not believe that the Torah that we have came from Hashem. Now, of course, the word Torah is an ambiguous word. Do you mean the five books of Moses? Do you mean the oral law? What do you mean by Torah here? But the upshot of this generally is that if I believe the Torah is wise, I believe the Torah is good. I keep the Torah. But I believe that it was good stuff that Moshe Rabbeinu made up, or the generations made up for sociological reasons, even if I'm totally frum, meaning I wear tefillin, I keep kosher, I do everything, but I don't believe it comes from Hashem, that already means you don't get a share in the world to come, because this is a very, very serious thing. Now, as I say, clearly we do understand that all the mitzvahs were given by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Moshe, and we also believe in the Torah Shebal Peh, the oral interpretation. There is going to be some question, well maybe it's not a question, but there are reports to discuss this, whether we are compelled to believe that every single letter of the Torah was dictated by Hashem. Now the Rambam, in his formulation, does tell us what has become the standard accepted idea in Judaism. That is, every single, it's not just the content of the Torah. It's not just the content. It's not just the commandments. But the actual, every single letter, every single word was dictated by HaKadosh Baruch Hu telling Moshe what to write. It's a word-for-word transcription. That's different, by the way, than the books of the prophets. You have to understand, what is the difference between the Torah and the Nevi'im? So one of the differences is, in the Torah is a word-for-word transcription from Hashem. Hashem told Moshe, write down Vayidaber, Hashem, El, Moshe, Lamor. With Nevi'im, the Mefarshim say it works a different way. They have visions. Hashem speaks to them. They have dreams. But they put it in their own words, meaning to say the actual words are not dictated words. The Navi expresses his prophetic images in the words of his choosing, although it was real prophecy. Hashem appeared to him and showed him things, which he then puts into his own words. That is why Chazal say different Nevi'im have a different style, because the concept of style now becomes relevant. If we ask what was Moshe Rabbeinu's style, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't have a style, because there was no aspect of style that pertains to Moshe Rabbeinu, because Moshe Rabbeinu is doing word-for-word transcription, right? The books of the Nevi'im are not word-for-word. So, I mean, some say they are, but many Mefarshim Bibar, but no one would like to make the point that Nevi'im are not word-for-word transcription, it's only the Torah. Now, granted, there is a machlokus in the Gemara who wrote the last 8 verses of the Torah. Why is there a machlokus? Because the last 8 verses talk about Moshe dying. Who wrote the words Moshe died? Right, so if, and you may remember, you may have learned this at the end of the first parak in Bava Basra. According to one opinion, Yahushua wrote those words after Moshe died. According to the other view, Moshe wrote them ahead of time with tears in his eyes as he was writing about his death. But it's important, and really punch it, but I want to say it anyway, because be sure you all get this, that is not at all a contradiction with the divine origin of the Torah, because even if Yahushua wrote it, he wrote it via dictation, meaning everybody says Hashem said what words to write. The Gemara doesn't mean Yahushua added some words as an appendix to the Torah. There is nothing in the Torah that was not dictated from Hashem. The only machlokus was, did Moshe do the whole thing, or was Yahushua the one that took over for the last 8 verses. So when it says, if you don't believe in Torah min Hashamayim, you don't have a share in Olam Haba, it doesn't just mean the mitzvahs. Let's say, I believe all the 613 mitzvahs come from Hashem. But I think some of the stories, you know, may not have happened, or some of the stories were added, or whatever it is. Or the Gemara says even a minor thing like the name of Esav's maidservants, which is not really minor, but, you know, we don't see the great importance of it. And if you say, oh, that was written in just to keep a family record by somebody. You have to believe every part of the Torah comes back. By the way, I just want to mention a difficult situation. So we've mentioned so far two things. A person doesn't believe in physical resurrection, and a person doesn't believe in the divinity of the Torah. Well, we look around and we ask ourselves, most Jews in the world, unfortunately, may not really share either one of these beliefs or both of these beliefs. So, you know, in the time of the Mishnah, you were excluding a relatively small percentage. I don't have an exact number. You say, well, 95% of you are okay, but there's this 5% of, you know, bad apples who are going to be in big trouble. But today, you're essentially talking about 15% of you will have Olam Haba, and 85% of you won't. That's pretty harsh, and it's very different than it was at the time of the Mishnah. Can it be possible that our sages, our chazal, are basically condemning 85 or 90%? And by the way, even some Orthodox people fail this test. There's a whole... Absolutely so. There was a whole article in the New York Times written by an Orthodox person who was making the argument, and it's going around the web, and it's an argument now, that as long as you do mitzvahs, you don't have to believe in anything. And he even said he didn't believe in the divine origin of the Torah, but he keeps mitzvahs. He compared it to what? He compared it to wearing a Jets jacket, whatever. Again, in other words, when you're part of a gang, this is your team, so you wear the dress. So he said he likes to keep kosher, he likes to daven, he likes to wear tefillin, because it's a way that he connects to his people, which is good. But he said specifically, he doesn't believe in a lot of the theology. So when we talk about, you know, so many Jews being excluded, it's not just non-religious Jews, even Jews who are religious. So the question is, how does that work? So one answer might be, or not one answer, but one idea to bring into the table here is that we find in many categories that the category of Tinok Shenishba is a paradigmatic case. That's a case of a kid who was kidnapped as a baby, raised among the Gentiles, was never exposed to anything. So there is a concept that Tinok Shenishba cannot be considered a rebellious person, and as a result, God does not hold him accountable for his lack of observance because he never knew anything. We use that in Or Sameach, I mean, based on other poskim. Technically, you know, we know if a non-Jew touches wine that's not cooked, the wine is treif, right? We know that. According to many opinions, if one desecrates Shabbos and touches such wine, since he's treated like an idol worshiper, the wine is treif. That's why we try to use cooked wine, because cooked wine, that doesn't happen. But the poskim say if the Jewish person was never raised to understand Shabbos, the touching of the wine will not make it treif. And although...
So can we use that disclaimer?
It's a machlokas. And what can I tell you? Most American rabbis are mekel, and most rabbis in Israel are machmer. Or sameach, we're mekel b'diyevin. Meaning to say, we try to use wine that's cooked. If it happens by accident that the wine was not cooked, you'd be allowed to drink it. But so here's the argument. If we excuse the Tinok Shenishba, who doesn't keep Shabbos, could we apply the Tinok Shenishba to things like, well, I never learned about resurrection of the dead. I never learned about the divine origin of the Torah. Can there be the concept of Tinok Shenishba on false ideas? Big, big machlokas. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik took a very strict view. He said that Tinok Shenishba can excuse you from doing sins if you didn't know they were wrong. But Olam Haba requires an admission ticket. The analogy would be, and he didn't use this analogy, let's say admission to a museum or a movie, kosher movie, costs a certain amount of money. Now you come to the ticket office and you say, I was robbed, I was mugged, you know, well, sorry, you know, you can't go in. Rav Chaim says, maybe the Tinuk Shenishba has all the excuses in the world, but the basic admission ticket isn't there. In Rav Chaim's famous phrase, Napikaris is Nebuch and Napikaris, meaning I feel sorry for him, but he's still a Napikaris. So according to Rav Chaim, Tinuk Shenishba doesn't work for this at all. The only thing you have is reincarnation. That's the only thing that's going to be left for this. However, there are other opinions that say that the same way there are mitigating circumstances in sins, there are mitigating circumstances in ideology as well. Now, even that's not going to help the Orthodox person who rejects, you know, that would help the person who just never learned. So this is a difficult issue, and we don't really have definitive halacha, because it's really what will God do when somebody dies, you know. We don't have a psak halacha about what God will do. But it is something to ponder with a bit of dismay, that we're no longer dealing with a tiny fringe element of rebellious Jews. We're dealing with the vast majority of the Jewish people at this particular point.
I heard the Rav say this on the issue. He said, "He is yad achok enach potevet min haonish."
Yes.
Being ignorant or stupid does not release you from your punishment. So not being educated.
You know, as a general rule, that's true. But that would apply in some cases only if you were in an environment where you had Jews who could have taught you and you could have learned from them, as opposed to the Tinoch, the captive baby, the kidnapped baby. That is a special level. So in such a situation, you know, there is a certain amount of exoneration, but the machlokas is, does that apply to basic ideas? Yeah.
Rabbi, with regard to the first exclusion to Olam Abba,
yeah.
You talk about the belief of the resurrection,
yeah.
The belief that it was written in the Torah.
Yeah.
Are you going to get to that?
I will get to that, because I haven't. The Gemara will discuss in detail, well, where, I mean, you know, in fact, you might be shivering right now. Well, I don't know where the case is. Okay. But you don't have to know where it is. As long as you believe it's in the Torah, even if you don't know where, you're going to be okay, so don't be scared. But we will see where it is alluded to. Actually, it's not explicit either, but it is alluded to in the Torah. And you have to believe that drasha is part of what Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu. So those are the first two. Now the third one is a term that we throw around quite a lot, but it does have a more precise definition. That is apikoros. So our big three, ein tchias amesa min haTorah, ein Torah min haShomayim, apikoros doesn't have a share in the world to come. Now, the word apikoros in modern Israeli religious society is so thrown around so much that if you carry in the Malot Akna Erev, you know, you might be called an apikoros, you know. And that's, you know, that's not what we are, that is not what we are talking about here at all. First of all, apikoros is not a Hebrew word, obviously, and what is the origin? Actually, it's a Greek term. Some connect it to the Greek philosopher Epicurus, like Epicurean, mm-hmm. And Epicurus. Actually, he wasn't such a theologically bad guy. I mean, you know, he was like every Greek believed in idolatry. I mean, he wasn't worse than that. But Epicurus was a hedonist who stressed that the highest goal in life was the pursuit of the physical. So essentially, he denied the idea of the soul. But the Gemara gives a different interpretation. Again, I'm getting ahead. I'm kind of telling you what the Gemara will say ahead of time, but we'll see it inside. The Gemara says that Epicurus refers primarily to someone who shames or humiliates Talmidei Chachamim, which is actually very, very interesting. That's a tough standard, because that could mean you could be the firmest guy in the world. You could be firm, you could learn all the time, right? We're not talking, you have all the right beliefs, Tchias HaMesim, Olam Haba, when you're Mavazeh Talmidei Chachamim, you have the status of Apikoros. Now, the circular way that people give themselves leeway here is they say, well, the person on Mavaza is not a Talmud Chacham by a proper definition. Right? Now, again, I mean, let me give you an example, but again, some will argue with my example. You know, the everyone knows Rav Kook, right? Rav Kook, first chief rabbi of Eretz Israel, who died before there was a state of Israel, was and continues to be a very, very controversial person. Rav Kook was a great gain, great, great master of halacha. He was Rav Yashiv's Masada Kedushin. He was Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's Rebbe. So Rav Kook had a tremendous impact on Gedolim. Rav Yashiv himself was very close to Rav Kook. But Rav Kook, because he was involved with secular Zionists, because he befriended Jews who were not keeping Shabbos, and he felt he could have a positive impact on them, he was considered to be a little suspect by some circles because of his involvement with secular people and encouraging them to do what they were doing. In fact, he spoke. See, this is an example. He really got a bad rap for this. One of the most controversial things that he was attacked for, and viciously attacked, was he spoke at the groundbreaking of Hebrew University in the 1920s. And, you know, he had no Haredi Rav, no went to that dedication. But he went to the dedication. He actually spoke at the dedication. And the last line of his dedication was that this university is an exemplar of the verse, Ki mitzion tetzei Sarah, that from Zion shall come forth the Torah. So he was lambasted. There were posters that he said that Hebrew University, which will teach Bible criticism and denial of Torah min Hashamayim, that's the Torah that comes from Eretz Yisrael. But and he was attacked. And so people said, "How can he? What kfira?" But if you look at the speech, it's exactly the opposite. He was giving mussar at the end. He was saying at the end of the speech, I saw the speech. He said that although it's important to have wisdom, we need medicine, and we need mathematics, and we need all these chachmas, but we have to remember that the most important thing in Eretz Yisrael is the Torah. He wasn't saying Hebrew University is the source of Torah. He was saying the opposite way around.
They pulled it out of context.
Yeah, they pulled it out of context. Maybe on purpose, or maybe by accident, but this is what they did. But the point is, what I want to say is this. If Gedolim had a machlokas with Rav Kook, and it was simply a machlokas about an idea or a hashgafa, that's a machlokas. Gedolim, we have machlokas. I mean, legitimate machlokas. The Gemara has machlokas. Gedolim have machlokas. There could be different opinions. But the lashonos that were used and are used, calling him, you know, a Russia, all sorts of words like that, a Russia, an apikoris, calling Rav Kook an apikoris is being an apikoris based on the definition. Because if the definition of apikoris is mavaza tamidei chachamim, this is an example. Okay, so that would be an example of being mavaza tamidei chachamim. To some degree, the same would be true with Chabad. Obviously, much of the Torah world has serious disagreements with some aspects of Chabad, particularly the idea of Mashiach and the like. But then, sometimes non-Chabad people use terms about the Lubavitcher Rebbe that are Mavaza Talmud Chacham, and that would fall under what the Mishnah calls Apikoros. Right? So, by all means, we look to our Gedolim, to our Rebbeim. There are differences of opinions in Klal Yisrael. There are Machloksim. There are Drachim that are maybe not considered correct for us to follow. Maybe I'm not even addressing that issue, but you know that could be true. But one does not resort to bizionos. And in recent time, I mean, I don't want to even talk about this so much, but it's so obvious, you know, there's a big machlokas now. I don't even know what the machlokas exactly is. I have a little bit of hint between Rav Shmuel Auerbach and Rav Chaim Kanievsky. Now, this is not like Chassid and Misnagdim. I mean, the difference in Ashgafa between Rav Shmuel and Rav Chaim Kanievsky, you know, I can't even describe. I mean, they're basically the same essential hashgafa, but there's a major, major machlokas how to deal tactically with the issue of yeshiva students and the draft. Machlokas among gedolim. Rav Chaim Kanievsky wants a more, Rav Steinman wants a more gradual, conciliatory approach, which Rav Auerbach feels you have to oppose it in a very strong way. But it's a machlokas, gedolim have machlokas, and people have talmidim. But, once again, the lashonos and the behaviors that followers are using. I don't want to say anything negative about any Jew, but certainly the lashonos that one would use either against Rav Chaim or against Rav Shmuel would absolutely qualify as being mevazeh a Talmud Chacham, which according to this is what an apikoros is.
How do we know the people follow
what an ashkenazi? Well, you have to talk to your rebbeim. I mean, like everything else. I mean, when you have a machlokas among gedolim, and you want to know what your own shita in life should be, so you need a Rebbe who knows you, that you feel connected to, who can give you individual guidance. I mean, people think sometimes that I only want to get guidance from the Gadol Hador. You know, the Gadol Hador is not the best person to give you guidance, because the Gadol Hador can set parameters of things. But the Gadol Hador doesn't know you, right? So we need people like middlemen, so to speak, who kind of know us and know the situation and can apply the Hadracha of Gedolim, right? It wouldn't be to your advantage that, you know, oh, I get to talk to Chaim Kanevsky directly. What are you going to get? You're going to get a minute, you know. So that's why every person needs a Rebbe. It's not enough to have a Gadol. You need an individual Rebbe that can kind of apply what the Gadol says to your situation. Okay? So this idea about Bikoris, Mavaza Thomas Chacham, is a real, real important thing, because unfortunately in the superheated political rhetoric of religion in Eretz Yisrael, this happens all the time, and this is a big, big aveira. Mavaza Thomas Chacham does not have a share in Olam Haba. So yes, machloksim there can be. Nobody's telling people to shut up about, you know, discussing issues and trying to understand the different views. But it should, I mean, one could say, my Rebbe might tell me the Rav Kook Shita is not for us, or maybe the Rav Kook Shita is for us. You know, that's, we can talk about that another time. But to be Mavaza at Thomas Chacham, and a Gadol especially, is a great, great avail. Yeah, so that's where you get, see, that's where you get into circular reason, because somebody says, in fact, in logic, there's an old argument called No True Scotsman. I don't know if you ever came across it. It's that argument where all Scotch people, you know, behave a certain way. And then you say, well, I know somebody from Scotland who doesn't. Well, he's not a real Scotsman. You can't refute it, because anyone who doesn't fit your definition isn't him. So that's the people who say, oh, yeah, of course, I'm not Mavaza at Talmud Chacham, but anyone on Mavaza is not a Talmud Chacham. Otherwise, I wouldn't be Mavaza. Well, but that kind of renders it meaningless. Who's going to be Mavaza somebody that he really thinks is a great Talmud Chacham? I mean, by definition, I'm Mavaza somebody who I think isn't up to it. So who defines it? You know, it is hard to say, because, once again, there are people who may have a lot of Torah knowledge who genuinely might be heretics in different ways, and the like. But I think you have to look at the guidance of Gedolim, that if somebody that at least some recognize Gedolim and respect, then you have to treat him as in the category of a Talmud Chacham, and you cannot go any further. And all I can tell you is, but by Rav Kook as a specific example, that we know that Rav Kook was greatly, greatly admired by Rav Yachiv, by Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. In fact, it's interesting that you know, in the Rambams, you know, these new Rambams have many Mephorshim in the back. So when they did Zerayim on agriculture, so one of the editors was a Haredi Ben Torah, and he was told to kind of summarize Rav Kook's writings on something, and he decided on his own that he wasn't going to summarize Rav Kook. He put in other Mephorshim. So when his boss, his editor-in-chief, discovered that he didn't do the job, he fired him. So the person demanded a din Torah in front of Rebbe Yashiv, and he wanted Rebbe Yashiv to tell the person that he was right to exclude Rav Kook, and he wanted his job back. He needed the parnasa. So he came to Rebbe Yashiv. Rebbe Yashiv said, "I would have fired you myself." He says, "Get out of here." He said, how dare you, Mugaza, a great kaddosh, a gain v'kaddosh, that Rav Kook was, right? So that's the thing. Okay, we'll stop here. We'll see you. That's right.